Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
Senate Republican leader Bill Frist today called on the Bush administration to stop a deal that would allow a state-owned company from the United Arab Emirates to take over operations at six major U.S. ports as of March 2nd. Frist's voice joins a chorus concerned about the pact. The governors of New York and Maryland are threatening to sue to stop the deal, which was approved by the Bush administration and made public last week, and would allow Dubai Ports World to acquire the British company that's currently running the ports of New York, New Jersey, Philadelphia, Baltimore, New Orleans, and Miami. And citing the 2001 terrorist attacks, New York Democrat Senator Charles Schumer says he will team up with a Republican congressman to file emergency legislation to stop the deal.
Two of the terrorists came from the United Arab Emirates, and the money that was laundered, that paid for the events, was laundered through United Arab Emirates banks.
Well, joining us on the line now from his cell phone is the mayor of Baltimore, Martin O'Malley. He's a Democrat who's also running for governor of Maryland. Mr. Mayor, you object to this deal. Why?
I object to this deal, Robin, because for the last several years, when we should have been investing in port security, we have not. The fact that the port like Hong Kong inspects and scans 100% of its cargo, and American ports are only inspecting 5%, is a serious vulnerability that all experts acknowledge. And we would compound that vulnerability by surrendering American ports to the control of any foreign government.
Well, let me hold you up there, because the British government, or at least a British company, has been controlling the courts. And as we know, many terrorists have come from Britain. So why wasn't there complaint then?
Well, you made an important distinction in asking the question, didn't you? It was not a foreign government that was running our ports. It was a private company, albeit one that had its headquarters based in Britain. It is not about, this is about America taking responsibility for port security in American ports. And we did not advance that cause by turning over the operations of our port to a foreign government. There's a big difference between a private company that is foreign-based and a company that is wholly owned by a foreign government.
Well, Homeland Security Secretary Michael Chertoff has defended the deal. He says secret assurances were in place to safeguard port security. Former President Jimmy Carter also supported the president in making the deal, as long as he said, the administration has adequately checked out DP World. And some port officials right there in Maryland have suggested that because Dubai Ports World has deep pockets and comes from a part of the world where they're used to defending against terrorism, they might actually improve security in your port.
Yeah, they might. And isn't it a sad statement upon our political will as a people, Robin, that we have more faith and are willing to pin our hopes on a foreign government investing in the security of our ports? Let's be honest here. Let's be brutally honest. 30% cuts to port security in the last 3 years of budgets coming out of Congress. This is not a Democratic or Republican issue. Democrats and Republicans alike are opposing the surrender of American ports to any foreign government. I never thought that I would see a day when we would have to rely on secret assurances and the public promises of a foreign ambassador regarding security at our ports. Look, well, we know what to do. We know what we need. We need to scan the cargo containers that come in. We need smart containers. We need to be able to track ships that 200 miles out before they arrive in American ports, and we need to do radiological screenings at their ports of departure before they come here. To try to just, go to do secure America on the cheap by hoping that the United Arab Emirates might be more willing to invest in America's security than we will is a really sad testament on our country's will to protect ourselves.
Well, Mayor O'Malley, you make the point, and it's well taken, that there's been an outcry from both sides of the aisle, and the outcry not just because it's a foreign government, but because it's an Arab government. But I ask you, in the minute we have left, how would it look if America, which is supposed to believe in free trade and in a market and democracy, stopped a sale outside of this country because of fears of an Arab country? One that's an ally, by the way.
I don't see this so much as I don't care whether it's an Arab country, an Irish country, a German or a Russian or a French country. No other country should be responsible for the operations of our ports, especially in a time when all experts acknowledge that we have been very irresponsible and woefully negligent in investing in the security of our ports. This is a time when we should be stepping up, not a time when we should be stepping back and surrendering the Port of Baltimore or any other port to a foreign country. This is America. We should never, ever close our borders to free trade. We should support free trade, but we should not abdicate our responsibility to secure our ports to the whims of a foreign country, whether it's Arab, Irish, German, or French.
Martin O'Malley, mayor of Baltimore, a candidate there, by the way, for governor of Maryland. Mayor O'Malley, thanks for speaking with us.
Thank you, Robin.
Well, 6 months after the Irish Republican Army declared an end to its armed campaign against British rule, the crime rate in Northern Ireland continues to soar. Earlier this month, talks between Democratic Unionists and Sinn Féin broke down after an independent monitoring commission reported that the Irish Republican Army is no longer engaging in terrorism, but is still spying on public officials and operating an organized crime network around the lucrative narcotics trade and trafficking contraband cigarettes and gas. Well, we want to spend a few minutes today looking at Northern Ireland post-peace process through the eyes of novelist Nick Laird. His new book paints an Ireland yearning for the way it used to be.
There was an intricate balance to Ballyglass. For every Protestant business, there was the Roman Catholic equivalent, sometimes right next door. It was an instance of the parallel universe becoming visible, as if two separate towns existed and somehow inhabited the very same space. The odd thing was that now peace, of sorts, had come. The big businesses from across the water had started arriving. Now the Protestant greengrocer, who'd always favoured carrots in his window display, and his Roman Catholic equivalent, who'd been fonder of cabbages and broccoli, were closing, along with various butchers and mini-marts. It was becoming apparent to the place that peace had its own difficulties, and it was only the troubles that kept the community structure.
Nick Laird reading from his debut novel, Utterly Monkey. It tells of Danny Williams, who's traded a town in Ulster Province for a career at an upscale law firm in London, a life that sounds a lot like the author's. Like Danny Williams, Nick Laird is a Northern Irish boy turned London lawyer. He also, like his character, fell in love with a beautiful black woman, novelist Zadie Smith. The two are now married. And author Nick Laird joins us in the studio. Welcome.
Thank you.
And so I've pointed out what was clear to us reading this splash over between you and your character, Danny Williams. He's fed up with selling his soul at a fancy law firm. What were you working out here?
not really anything. People always ask me about the autobiographical aspects of it. And there are obviously parallels between us. We're both Northern Irish. We both worked in London. But I kind of started writing the book. And then once you introduce the characters, they kind of go their own way. And
right.
All you can do is kind of watch them.
But you have said you were sort of, I think the phrase was, hacked off at your job.
I certainly was, yeah. I took a sabbatical for 6 months and went to Harvard and started writing the novel. I knew I needed to get sort of a long period of time to have a go at writing a long piece of fiction. And so I went back to work afterwards to try and do both, to finish the novel and keep working in the law firm. But I just didn't have time, so I had to resign.
Yeah, and at that time, by the way, we mentioned Zadie Smith, your wife. She was also at Harvard in 2003.
Sure.
Writing her book on beauty.
That's right.
Did you know you wanted to be a writer?
Oh, sure. I mean, Zadie and I we met at Cambridge when we were 18, and we've always written together. I mean, we were both up for the writing prize in our last year at Cambridge, and I beat her for it.
Ah.
And I got a £60 book token, and then Zadie signed a book contract for White Teeth 2 weeks later, which was worth considerably more. But we've always written together and, critiqued each other's work. And for a long time, I wrote mostly poetry, but I reviewed a lot of fiction for various newspapers and for the last 10 years, like the TLS and stuff in England. Mm. It was just a question of me needing time to try and write a long
right.
fiction piece.
And the one you've written is just a terrific read. The politics and economics of Northern Ireland catch up with your character, Danny, in the form of his childhood friend, Geordie, who shows up at Danny's door sort of like a shadow of his past. Who is Geordie? Tell us what he symbolizes.
I think what I was thinking of with that is you know people, everyone's got kind of feckless friends from home who are still, you know, feckless friends who still live at home. But I was more interested in the fact that the only thing that separates these two men really is education. I mean, in some ways they're from different classes even originally, but, you know, Jody has stayed behind in Ballyglass. Things haven't worked out for him particularly well. Danny's kind of moved on and tried to leave it behind, and Jody doesn't really like the fact that this has happened to Danny either. He wants to bring him back and he wants him to be the person he was. So I suppose Jody comes to symbolise your own history, which you can't get away from.
Right.
But Jody's a lot of fun as well. It's not just like he's a bad thing for Danny. Danny's a little bit uptight and Jody loosens him up as well.
Right, in that way that he might also remind him of home.
Yeah.
In that way. Well, and there's another character, Janice, who is dating Jody, and she's also stuck in Ballyglass.
Yeah.
And here's where the romance of the neighbourhoods in which the troubles took place is stripped away by you. She lives in a home that reeks of cigarette smoke and is too crowded, and her abusive brother who doesn't know what to do with himself now that the IRA seems to be dismantled. And you know, you're unsparing there.
Well, I mean, it's a tough life. She needs to get away from it, and eventually, you know, she does get away from it, but she doesn't know any different, I suppose, so it's her family and it's where she lives.
It's such an unflinching eye that you turn on these neighborhoods that, you know, used to invest a lot of energy in the troubles and now are sort of... In fact, all the characters seem to be wondering, what am I supposed to do now?
Well, Northern Ireland's in a strange position. I mean, it kind of is still... It's not like the troubles have finished, really. I mean, obviously the peace process is ongoing, but... I mean, Northern Ireland is in the grip of organised crime. It's got a terrible criminal problem. It's run by mafia-like groups. It's got the worst organised crime in Europe. I mean, even the mafia was founded in Sicily or whatever, not dissimilar to the IRA, as a kind of reaction force, and then became interested in money, which is exactly what's happened in Northern Ireland. And we've got 24 serious criminal gangs who run the whole thing. I mean, Gallagher's Cigarettes, who are one of the biggest cigarette manufacturers, they won't even drive the cigarettes from the north to the south of Ireland now. They have to go by boat because they get hijacked at the border so much.
Yeah. Well, and Danny goes back to this world he thought he might have escaped from. And here is where he's really challenged, because his firm is handling a takeover that would leave more than 1,000 of his Northern Ireland fellow citizens unemployed.
Sure.
If Geordie is trying to find his place, how is Danny trying to find his place?
I think what I was interested in is I worked as a lawyer, and you can kind of convince yourself that what you're doing, the ends of your actions don't really, you know, that you can convince yourself that your actions don't have consequences. But of course, that's not true. And I was interested to see in the way that people perpetrate different kinds of violence. And Danny himself is perpetrating different kinds of violence, of corporate violence, and doesn't think about it and allows himself to kind of ignore it. And I wanted him to kind of be forced to come to terms in a way with the ends of his own actions. Mm. So I kind of wanted him to have to follow it through and see what he was doing and how, you know, what flowed from it.
Author Nick Laird, his new book is called Utterly Monkey. When we come back, we'll hear more from Nick on race, on lifting language from Henry James, and the many ways to say ugly in Irish slang. Stay with us, much more ahead, here and now. With Nick Laird, author of Utterly Monkey, a novel set in Northern Ireland and England, where the Irish lad Danny is climbing the ladder of a posh law firm. That part is kind of love and terrorism meet the TV sitcom The Office. Danny falls for a beautiful black co-worker named Ellen, much as author Nick Laird met and married novelist Zadie Smith in real life. But in the novel, Danny's much less worldly friend Geordie comes to London, perhaps as another metaphor for an Ireland emerging from the Troubles, you know, discovering a different world outside his own close-knit one. Nick Laird, can you read us the passage? Geordie has just arrived in London. He's walking down Stokington High Street. Here's his reaction.
He'd not seen so many different shades of skin before. Geordie, Danny had learned last night in the pub, had never tried garlic or pasta, unless tinned spaghetti is pasta. Neither had he drank wine outside a church, or eaten an aubergine, a courgette, or a sweet potato. Geordie felt himself in a new position, the outsider. He felt white. He couldn't stop looking at the black people he saw. The skin looked polished. They were beautiful. In Ridley Road Market, he thought he was about to get his head kicked in for staring. He was looking at a broad-shouldered young black man wearing a brown leather jacket and a gold-buttoned white shirt with a Nehru collar.
Are the Northern Irish, and you were one, were you that isolated? Did you have that feeling when you came to...
I did, actually. I mean, whenever I got to Cambridge when I was 18, I'd never met a Jewish person. I'd never had garlic. I'd never had a curry. I mean, maybe it's partly the family that you grew up in, but Northern Ireland, we didn't have outside shops. We didn't have big chains of supermarkets. No one invested in Northern Ireland. We had local shops. And it was a closed place. It was also very safe in lots of ways. I mean, there was no drugs problem in Northern Ireland because the security was so tight. Those things have changed now. I mean, the drugs in Northern Ireland is a real problem because it's been run by criminal gangs and both sort of Republican and Loyalist militias.
Yeah. Well, then, of course, we can't help but ask as well, you ultimately married a black woman. As Danny falls for Ellen, you apparently fell.
Right. I wouldn't read too much into Ellen being Zadie because they're very unlike each other, and I'm very unlike Danny. All I was interested in was the idea that race would come to be unimportant, and I mean it's never mentioned that in London. London now is so multicultural. I don't like that term, but it's a very ethnically diverse place, and I wanted the book to kind of show that London race is not an issue really for a lot of people and isn't even noticed. And for Danny, the race is never mentioned. He's not concerned with the race at all. It's only Geordie. And I wanted that to be so that you could see the difference really in those two outlooks and how things have moved on for Danny. So.
Yeah. In fact, whereas Geordie doesn't know what to make of the different faces he's seeing, Danny knows the face he's looking at is beautiful.
Sure.
And he's just fascinated with it. We're talking with Nick Laird. His new novel is called Utterly Monkey. And speaking of the title, there are a lot of phrases in here that you need your sort of Irish slang.
Your Irish head on.
So, and I just want to ask what some of them are. Stealthy as a verger?
Verger.
Verger? What's that?
A verger is a man in church who helps out the reverend, and like stealthy as a verger, it's meant to be like he would, if you get in communion or whatever, the verger would pass around the chalice of wine, or the verger would collect like for the offerings for whenever you put money in the plate.
Like a deacon.
Like a deacon. Mm-hmm.
What is Larry?
Larry is...
L-A-I-I-R-Y.
Yeah, Larry is like aggressive kind of... I was going to say orgy, but you don't know what orgy means either. someone who's very argumentative and belligerent.
Yeah, and then the topper of all of them is when one of the characters is walking around the zoo and he sees an animal in a cage and he says, it's very eleemosynary.
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 You know, sometimes you have to just push the boundaries and see what you can get into the book. I've only seen Henry James uses that word in one place, and I just liked it so much, I thought, if I ever finish a novel, I'm going to put that in.
What does it mean?
Eleemosynary, it's Ian's in the zoo, and he sees two small monkeys or macaques, and one of them has his hand out through the cage, and eleemosynary means begging for alms.
Oh.
So it's like asking for, you know, money.
That's not slang.
It's not slang.
But so much of it is.
Good word, though, isn't it?
It is, and there's so many great words here. I mean, you obviously have a love of words.
Yeah, I've always liked language and been interested in it. I mean, I studied English at Cambridge, and I think even in law, I mean, you know, writing witness statements and interviewing people and drafting arguments, it's all about words, really.
Yeah. The Times magazine in London said that your novel's strength lies in the plot, but also the quality of the language, the defamiliarizing objects such as a tuba, which becomes the ear of a bronze colossus in your writing. Well, having talked about words, I can't let you go without asking, Utterly Monkey. Danny and Geordie at one point in the book talk about women, and Geordie asks him if anyone's coming over to a party who isn't totally monkey. And that was a phrase that you made up?
Yeah, I made it up. And whenever you talk in a dialect, there's always lots of words for certain things. There's lots of words for getting drunk, and there's lots of words for ugly people. And it's kind of explained how the story came about. Danny and Geordie they'd picked up two women at one point, and they were in a place called Monkey Lane. And
when they were kids, when they were young.
When they were kids, and one of the girls they were with, something happened, which then came to symbolise something very bad. Something bad.
We won't go any further.
No, I'm getting myself tangled up.
Except that you also, you not only make up the phrase, but you give synonyms for it, such as gipping. She's a gipping trout.
Gipping. That's
gipping.
Real. People do say gipping.
They do. Yeah. Minging.
Minging.
Manky. Boiling.
Munting.
Rancid and raw.
Yeah, those are all real. It's a very vital language that we speak.
Nick Laird, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Nick Laird's new novel is called Utterly Monkey. And this note, this news has just come into us. Serbia's state news agency says top war crimes fugitive General Ratko Mladic has been arrested in Belgrade. We'll have more on that important story tomorrow, as well as a discussion of a popular new Turkish film that's putting anti-Americanism and anti-Semitism on the big screen. That's all tomorrow. As always, we'd love to hear your thoughts on anything on the program. Our email address is letters@here-now.org. That's letters@here-now.org. Or you can give us a call. You can always leave a message at 617-358-0397. 617-358-0397. Please remember to include your full name, your phone number, and your town. Stay with us. Much more ahead here and now. Funding for Here and Now comes from 2006 Winter Olympics are filled with drama. Tumbling ice dancers, treacherous downhill terrain, accusations around the speed skating oval, oh, and that American snowboarder who nearly touched gold. Well, we'll have more on what's ahead of the games in just a moment. But first, another drama outside the competition saw an already banned Austrian coach fleeing the country in a cops and robbers chase that ended in a car crash and a trip to the psychiatric ward. Austrian ski coach Walter Meyer is now on a suicide watch. He fled Italy this weekend after the first ever police drug sweep of Olympic athletes, which turned up syringes at the Austrian ski team's lodge. Officials are now testing those syringes for illegal drugs. Peter Ford of the Christian Science Monitor has been covering the investigation into possible doping. Peter, what sparked this raid in the first place?
Well, officials from the World Anti-Doping Agency, who were keeping a surveillance on the mountains, spotted Meyer, and they tipped off the IOC. The IOC then tipped off the Italian police.
Because Meyer wasn't allowed to be there.
Meyer was banned from the Olympics because he was involved in a blood doping scandal in Salt Lake City. And his presence anywhere near the Austrian team will be regarded as breaking at least the spirit of the ban, if not the letter, since he's not the official coach. He was in Italy in a private capacity. But he was seen there. It's acknowledged that he slept one night in the Austrian team housing. And on Saturday night, the Italian police raided Austrian skiers' housing in the middle of the night. They took away a lot of syringes. They took away a lot of medication and preparations. And we're still waiting to hear whether the Italian police have found anything banned in the stuff that they confiscated. They're expected to say so tomorrow.
Well, they also, you know, really upset the apple cart of these Austrian athletes. How are athletes reacting to this?
Well, the Austrians are extremely upset. I mean, as you can imagine, the four of them had a relay race the next day. They came last out of 16 teams, which is not surprising since three of them had only had 3 hours sleep and one didn't sleep at all. The Austrian team are saying there is no evidence of any doping, that they don't go in for doping, and that it's outrageous that the police should have behaved like this. But in Italy, under a new law, doping is a criminal offence, and if anybody is found guilty, if anybody is found suspicious, they will be charged by the Italian courts and will have to appear before Italian courts.
And Peter Ford, do the athletes bear some blame, or at least the Austrian officials, for allowing this banned coach to sleep in the lodge?
Well, it seems very foolish indeed. I think even if he hadn't been allowed into the housing, the World Anti-Doping Agency officials would have been suspicious that he was even in the vicinity. He is in touch with the Austrian team. The Austrian skiers have acknowledged that they have been dealing with him, that he has been helping them off and on this season. Given that he has formally banned from these Olympics and from the Vancouver Olympics after allowing and helping Austrian athletes to dope their blood in Salt Lake City, I think that the Austrians really, frankly, only have themselves to blame for attracting suspicion.
Peter Ford of the Christian Science Monitor speaking to us from Turin. Peter, thanks so much.
You're welcome.
And we now turn to skating. Now, if you don't want to know the results in the men's 1500, turn down your radio and count to about 30. Are we alone? Okay. Italy's Enrico Fabri thrilled the home crowd and stunned the favorites by taking the gold medal in the men's 1500-meter race. Most watchers were picking it to be a battle between the U.S.'s Shawnee Davis and Chad Hedrick, who ended up second and third, respectively. But though that race is over, the discord between the two men may not be. Earlier today, we spoke to Helene Elliott. She's sports reporter for the Los Angeles Times, and she spoke to us about the rivalry.
It's been an interesting dynamic, and that whole team has been kind of a fractured, dysfunctional family over there. You know, Shawnee Davis has done a lot of things on his own. At one point, his biography was even removed from the U.S. speed skating website. That's how antagonistic things had gotten. Right. These two guys really don't like each other a whole lot.
It has been a little tough to watch. Chad Hedrick accusing Shawnee Davis of not being a team player because Shawnee Davis did not want to skate in the relays. He wanted to save himself for his individual event, and then he won the gold medal, first African-American man to individual in the Winter Olympics. So how is the sports world viewing that toss-up?
That's a very good question. It seems to be pretty evenly divided between the folks who think, hey, you should be a team player, he should have skated the relay, and had he skated that relay, they might have won. They very well might have won. But you can also see Shawnee Davis' side of it. He's prepared his whole life for this. He wanted to stay fresh for his individual race, so I certainly don't blame him for that.
Well, on to the women's figure skating, in which we've already seen some drama. Michelle Kwan dropping out, replaced by the young and remarkably composed Emily Hughes. And then there's also the mysterious Sasha Cohen on the women's team. The Christian Science Monitor writing today that her practice location is known only to the CIA.
With all due respect to the Christian Science Monitor, I don't think that's very fair to Sasha Cohen. Everybody knew where the place was, and Kimmy Meisner was skating there as well. I wonder if they would have said the same thing about Kimmy Meisner.
That brings up, you know, a question. Sasha Cohen, there seems to be, and you tell me, there seems to be a lot of expectation of her, maybe some disappointment in her on the part of sports writers. Tell us about that.
Well, it's really kind of an awkward situation or an interesting situation because we put so much pressure, everybody put so much pressure on these young women, and they're doing an incredibly difficult sport. They're also, for the most part, young girls. They're growing. They're going through a lot of changes in their lives. And there's a lot of emotional changes, not just physical changes. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of pressure on these kids. And we put them on the cover of Time and Newsweek and in newspaper stories and you know, declare them failures if they win only, quote-unquote, a silver medal instead of a gold medal. Mm-hmm. And that's a horrible thing to do. And, you know, certainly as journalists, we're all part of this. We're part of the problem, I suppose. You know, Sasha Cohen still has to get over a certain psychological hurdle of being able to perform two good, error-free programs in one competition. She really hasn't done that. Now the situation is set up perfectly for her to do that. Michelle Kwan is not here. There are really no other people, I don't think, who can challenge her and Slutskaya. The two of them, I believe, are clearly the best skaters in this field.
That's Irina Slutskaya, the Russian.
Correct. And I don't think there's anybody who's really near their skills. Some of the Japanese women are very good, but I don't think they have the artistry that Sasha Cohen does, and they don't have the technical skills that Irina Slutskaya does. So this is Sasha Cohen's moment, really, and this is her time to seize the moment and to do what everybody has been waiting for her to do.
Is there any chance of the young Emily Hughes or some of the other youngsters who really aren't in the top five to come from behind, as Emily Hughes' sister Sarah Hughes was said to have done, you know, when she won her gold?
The big difference is, and it's a lovely story, you know, the parallels between the sisters and all that, but when Sarah Hughes went to the Olympics in 2002, she was a far more accomplished skater at that point in her career than Emily is. Sarah Hughes had already finished third at the World Championships at the senior level. Emily Hughes has never competed at the World Championships at the senior level. She's only been at the junior level.
Well, and as you've been pointing out, it is a delightful story that she's there.
Absolutely. She's a delightful kid. She looks like a normal human being, a normal teenager, not some of these very teeny tiny, eensy weensy skaters that you see out there.
You mentioned the tiny skaters, and I just want to ask you about one who's not even there, who some say may be one of the best skaters in the world. She's the Japanese skater who wasn't old enough to come this year.
Right. Mao Asada probably had the best season of any skater in the world and won the Grand Prix final. She's not here. She missed the cutoff date for the age minimum by about, I think it was about 4 or 5 months. And it's really kind of a shame. You'd like to see the best go against the best.
Los Angeles Times sports reporter Helene Elliott on a very busy day in Turin. Thank you so much, Helene, for giving us some of your time.
You're welcome.
And you're listening to Here and Now. Avian flu continues to spread across Asia and Europe. Today, Hungary confirmed 3 dead swans were infected with the deadly H5N1 virus, and Malaysia began killing birds after reporting its first case in more than a year. Well, new research released this week says that bird flu is just one of a growing number of pathogens making the leap from animals to humans. A study released at the American Association for the Advancement of Science shows that most of the 38 new diseases that have appeared in humans over the last 25 years started in animals. Mark Woolhouse is an epidemiologist at the Center for Infectious Diseases at the University of Edinburgh in Scotland. He joins us from St. Louis, where the meeting's being held. And Dr. Woolhouse, give us some context for this. You know, one would think that over the course of history, this has been going on. Illnesses have been making this jump from animals to humans.
Well, that's exactly right. Humans have 1,400 different types of pathogen infecting them. That's microorganisms like bacteria and viruses and so on. And a very large number of those are associated with animals as well. Well over half of them are associated with animals. Now, the pathogens that have made the jump from animal reservoirs into human populations, that's a process that's been going on for millennia. That's the process that gave us things like tuberculosis, like measles, like smallpox and influenza. But the point is that it's clearly still going on today in modern times. Examples include things like the HIV virus that causes AIDS, the coronavirus that caused SARS, or the human form of mad cow disease. Bird flu is just yet one more example.
What would the modern-day concerns be? You mentioned tuberculosis and other illnesses, which people feel that they've, adapted to isn't the right word, but at least been able to control in some ways. So what are the concerns about the more recent pathogens?
The most striking example of a pathogen that's made the jump is the HIV virus that caused AIDS. So that's gone from its origins as a virus of primates on the west of Africa a few decades ago to becoming, in less than 20 years, one of the world's major killers.
And what is different about the world we live in that causes concern for researchers such as yourself?
What seems to be happening is it's the way in which humans are living their lives and interacting with their environment that's providing pathogens with new opportunities to make these kind of jumps. So we're talking about things that are going on all over the world, things like deforestation for agriculture, intensification of livestock farming, the use of exotic livestock and exotic pets, population growth and urbanization, global travel, global trade. These are all providing new opportunities for pathogens to jump into human populations and to spread within the population.
What in general happens when an animal disease is transferred to people? We mentioned avian flu, which has been transferred from birds to people, but almost not at all from people to people. But what happens when that happens? Does an animal disease generally get stronger or weaker? Does it mutate?
Most pathogens that make the jump are like avian influenza. They can't spread particularly well in human populations. Some of them, however, do manage to adapt to a new host and spread much better within humans. HIV, AIDS, and the SARS coronavirus are two good examples of that. Now, those pathogens both come from a class called the RNA viruses, which are special in an important way. They have small genomes, that is, they don't have much genetic material. They also have very high mutation rates. Now, that means that when they get the opportunity to jump into a new host, such as us, they can evolve very rapidly. And if they're able to adapt to the new host so they can spread better within it, they can do that.
Is that the fear of avian flu, that it might learn how to do that?
Influenza is another one of these RNA viruses. And we don't know which strain of avian influenza, there are many strains, not just H5N1, might one day evolve to be able to spread in humans, but that is the current fear.
Right now it seems that the attempts to stop avian flu have been to cull bird populations. Do you feel that's the right way to tackle the problem?
There are many different control options on the table for avian influenza. They include culling. They also include vaccination. There are vaccines available against avian influenza. And very importantly, and certainly for the more developed countries in the world, biosecurity for our chicken populations is extremely important, trying to keep the disease out in the first place.
Mark Woolhouse is speaking to us from the American Association for the Advancement of Science meeting in St. Louis. They've just released a report documenting 38 new pathogens, at least new to researchers, in humans, and many of those may have come from animals over the past 25 years. Dr. Woolhouse, thanks for speaking with us.
You're very welcome.
Stay with us. Much more ahead here and now. This quick news note, the Supreme Court today said it will reconsider the constitutionality of the federal ban on late-term abortion after a request by the Bush administration. The law was passed in 2003 but never put into effect because it was struck down by judges in California, Nebraska, and New York. The outcome will test the new composition of the court. In 2000, justices voted 5-4 to strike down a state law barring late-term abortion, saying it lacked an exception to protect the health of the mother. Justice O'Connor, who was the tie-breaking vote in that case, retired last month and was replaced by Samuel Alito. During Alito's nomination hearings, he refused to call Roe v. Wade the settled law of the land, and in a 1985 memo, argued that the Constitution does not protect a woman's right to abortion. Have you ever searched for someone else with your name? Maybe in the phone book, or maybe you've Googled it.
This is Grace Lee.
Hi, my name is Grace Lee.
Hi, my name is Grace Lee.
Hi, my name is Grace Lee.
Hello, director Grace Lee has taken that search to a new level in her documentary, The Grace Lee Project. Growing up in Missouri, Grace was the only Grace Lee and one of only two Asian kids in her neighborhood, the other being her sister. It wasn't until she left her hometown that she realized that her name was really popular, especially among Asian Americans. So Grace embarked on a journey to find out why. What's really in a name? She even set up her own website just for Grace Lee's.
The response is overwhelming. Grace Lee's contact me from all over the world. They're mostly from California and New York. But Grace Lee's log in from places like Iowa City and Singapore, England, and the Cayman Islands.
Grace set out to break down stereotypes of Asian women, but along the way she found unexpected similarities in how people were given the name. It could have been because of the name's Christian roots. One woman was named after a missionary. Or because of a parent's obsession with the Hollywood star Grace Kelly. Here and now intern Angela Kim caught up with filmmaker Grace Lee at the Film Forum in New York City.
I went to UCLA for film school, so I would always look at the directory and I would get emails from, I never met the other Grace Lees, but I would get emails from people looking for those other Grace Lees. One time I got an email from a guy asking if he could borrow my science notes. And one time I got another email from another guy who asked me if I went to the junior prom with him. But he had lost touch with his Grace Lee. So
I had read that you found a Mexican-American woman whose name was Grace Lee, but you decided to focus it just on Asian-American women. Why did you decide to do that?
Because I would never finish this film. No, there are definitely Grace Lees who are not Asian. I mean, there are a lot of Grace Lees who are Caucasian. There are a lot of African-American Grace Lee, as I met this Mexican Graciela Lee. But I really wanted to focus on this Asian-American phenomenon of Grace Lee sort of representing like the quintessential Asian woman.
In fact, after going through almost 200 surveys, a distinct portrait emerges from my not-so-scientific study. To begin, Grace Lee is American-born. She's of Korean ethnicity, and her parents are immigrants. She lives in California. She's 25 years old. She's heterosexual, single, and she averages 3.5 years of piano lessons. She's 5'3". She graduated from college and probably has a master's degree, at least. She has combination skin. Does any other name scream generic Asian girl more than Grace Lee?
There's this interesting thing where Grace Lee was completely impressive but totally forgettable at the same time. And I thought the way people talked about their Grace Lees is sort of the way people talk about a lot of Asian Americans in general or Asian people in general in a stereotypical way. So I thought it would be an interesting experiment to find out who these Grace Lees were, why were so many women named Grace Lee, and find out something about what it means to be an Asian woman today. I think that, you know, it would be fun to explore some of these other Grace Lees. Like, I did talk to a few white Grace Lees who talked about always being mistaken for being Asian. One woman was a student at UCLA where there are 10 Grace Lees, and she's studying pre-med, and she was white from Texas and constantly getting, you know, mistaken for being Chinese or Korean. I thought that was kind of funny.
You know, when you met these different Grace Lees, were there, I guess, certain ones you identified with?
The interesting thing about all the Grace Lees, the ones that I picked to focus on in the film, there's something about all of them that appealed to me or, you know, somehow represented a part of me. I mean, aside from the name, yeah, I mean, you have everyone from a teenager to, you know, a 90-year-old woman, you know, and I think that there are certain qualities that all of them have.
Speaking of the 90-year-old Grace Lee, she was, I don't know, she really stood out for me when I watched the film. She just had so much energy.
Well, we used to call her Grace X because she was such a revolutionary.
Every one of us who lives in this capitalist society has been damaged by the society, and to create a new society where it's not only struggle about what against what exists, but also transform ourselves.
And I became so active in the Black Power movement that FBI records of that time say that I was probably Afro-Chinese.
Oh, Grace Lee Boggs, who is a activist slash philosopher in Detroit and has been, as a Chinese-American woman, active in the Black civil rights and everyone's civil rights, I guess, struggle for more than 50 years. I met her, actually, probably at the beginning of the process, and she understood exactly what I was doing. You know, I wanted to sort of break down stereotypes of Asian women, and she herself sort of blows every stereotype, not just about Asians, but about, you know, senior citizens or everything that you can think of. She kind of, you know, upturns your expectations.
The sense of oneself as a woman is something that you are much more aware of than I was. I didn't think of myself, you know, I didn't think of myself so much as Chinese. You keep asking me this. I didn't think of myself so much as Chinese American. I didn't think of myself so much as a woman because the Chinese American movement hadn't emerged and the women's movement hadn't emerged. So I didn't have that consciousness. I don't think of you so much in terms of your name as I think of you in terms of what you do.
Of course, it was really inspiring to meet her, and I can only aspire to be like her when I'm in my 90s.
Can you tell me about some of the Grace Lees that didn't make it into the film?
There are so many Grace Lees that I wish I could have included, but, you know, the length of the film is only so long. And, you know, for example, there's the Filipina cruise ship singer whose stage name is Grace Lee. I mean, her given name is Grace, but I think her last name is something else. But she just told me she loved the name Grace Lee, you know, and she thought, you know, people would call it out on the cruise ship and, you know, they loved that. And, you know, I wish that Bruce Lee's mother was still alive because she was also a Grace Lee. Everybody always asks me, oh, is there, what about a Grace Lee in prison? Or is there like a transvestite Grace Lee? And, you know, maybe if one of them is listening to this broadcast, they can contact me at gracelee.net. But I didn't meet them in my travels.
Does this mean there's going to be a sequel to this possibly one day?
I always joke that the sequel will be episode 2, Attack of the Clones. But maybe, you know, we never know. I mean, maybe, or maybe some other Grace Lee will want to take up, you know, the remake.
And that's why I know Grace has made a change in my life.
That was Grace Lee, director of the Grace Lee Project at New York City's Film Forum, where she spoke with Here and Now intern Angela Kim. You can find more information about the Grace Lee Project and read a blog by Angela at our website, here-now.org.
Say them no more. What a wonderful change, oh, in my life since Grace found me.
Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Please join us again, Here and Now.
Oh, since Grace found me.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.
I'm Robin Young. Join us next time.